No.
Hi, Manuel Meyer, University of Bern. So I have a question about slide 39, where you show the plot of the structure growth rate. And I know you did mention that the huge error bars, but you still somehow managed to like fit a curve that corresponds to this logarithmic derivative in there. I could think of a constant that would fit to the data as well. So how is this curve justified?
Hello? That curve is not a fit to that data. That curve is you get hold of the Planck data, assume lambda CDM, which is GR with a cosmological constant, and you predict that curve. Okay? So that curve is not a fit to that data. And then you overlay the data, and this is what you get. I completely agree that if we hadn't used lambda CDM, at the moment, the data is such that we can fit anything to it. Now, bear in mind, look at the axis. It goes from, it's 10% errors on those things, so it's not really any curve. It's a curve which will be close to that, but you're right, it could be like this, it could be like that. But that curve is not a fit to that data. It's consistent with it.
Thank you.
Popov?
Fedor Popov, IT at Moscow. Can you explain why do cosmologists study all theories only classical level without study loop corrections to it and the others?
So
quantum distributions.
It depends on which cosmologists or which regime you're studying. If you're looking at very early universe, if you're looking at the very early universe, you have to worry about these quantum corrections. You're looking at very high energies. But look at the energy scales I'm looking at. As I said, I'm looking at the late times. I'm studying the system at energy scales of 10 to the minus 3 electron volts. Really minute energy scales. Okay? And so, and I'm looking on very large scales. So even from an effective field theory point of view, it doesn't make any sense to worry about quantum corrections on these macroscopic scales. Now, there's something else that you could ask, which is, if you look at these theories, are they consistent? Are they quantum mechanically consistent? And I would agree with you that a lot of these theories aren't quantum mechanically consistent. But yet again, let me echo the discussion that we just had in the previous discussion, which is, these are effective field theories. So we don't need to worry about that at the energy scales that we're studying.
Okay, thank you.
Steve Cole? Hello, do you hear me? My name is Sofia Zhitkova from Moscow State University. We know that the black hole in a universe without lambda parameter is described by Schwarzschild metric. So how we can describe the black hole, the metric of the black hole in the expanded universe?
Okay, so I think there are two questions there, right? The first question is, a black hole in a universe with no lambda, so I assume it's asymptotically flat universe,
yes,
is described in terms of the Schwarzschild metric. If you add a cosmological constant, there is a solution which is called the Schwarzschild-De Sitter metric. And so you have to add in, if you remember in the Schwarzschild metric, it's 1 minus gm over c squared r, then you have to add in a plus lambda r over c squared. So the G00 of the metric and the GRR, you have to correct it that way. But then there's another question you're asking, which is, how do you embed these black holes in an expanding universe? And it turns out you can do this. There's something called the Einstein-Strauss model, where you can embed the solution of a black hole, and you can asymptotically embed it into a Friedman universe. So it's possible to glue. There are very few situations in which you can do that, but you can do that in that situation.
Thank you. And one more question. How the gravitational radius of the black holes change in the expanded universe?
I don't think it does change. It's basically, you know, you're in a regime, you're in a strong gravity regime, so it doesn't really care about the expansion of the universe.
Thank you.
Any further question?
Mikola Savisky, Daisy Hamburg. Today you have mentioned that there are some effects due to the primordial gravitational waves. Well, as far as I know, that BSEP2 announced the observation of the primordial gravitational waves, but afterwards this statement was cancelled, right? And what can be the object behind radiation of these gravitational waves from the primordial order?
Let me try and understand. Are you asking me what gives origin to the gravitational waves?
Primordial ones.
Waves.
And what? Basically, this were not yet confirmed, right?
No, we haven't seen them yet. And unfortunately, the problem is, as I showed yesterday, I think in a plot, if you try and look for gravitational waves sitting within the galaxy, the idea is that you look at polarization of the cosmic microwave background. And it turns out that the polarization of the galaxy, which we're in, is a factor of 100 to 1,000 to 10,000 greater than the polarization that you would get from these primordial gravity waves. So we have to come up with a clever mechanism or clever technique for analyzing the data to extract the primordial gravitational waves. So that's the first answer. But the second answer, the second thing you asked me is, where do these primordial gravitational waves come from? Okay? And it's exactly the same mechanism that generates the density perturbations. What you have is that you have quantum fluctuations on small scale. In this case, it's spin 2 fluctuations of space-time. The universe expands very rapidly. Well, it's actually very quite slowly, but it pushes exponentially. It pushes, it stretches the wavelengths of these gravitational fluctuations, these gravitons, to super-horizon scales, to very large scales. And then, at the end of inflation, this is imprinted on space-time, and as the universe expands, the horizon gets bigger, and these gravitational waves come into the horizon. So that's the mechanism by which you produce. It's quantum noise in the gravitational field, which is stretched to super-horizon scales, and then comes back in.
Are there further questions or remarks?
Yes.
Over there.
Yes. Yes, Jan Sola from Barcelona. As you said, this curve here, F times sigma 8, in fact, is a prediction of the standard model, lambda CDM, not fit to this data. So, of course, unless we fit this data in some other way, we don't know whether it is very good or not. There are other models in the market, some recent ones, by the way. I have one on my screen right now here, in which fit this data better than in the lambda CDM. And as you know, this is a highly non-trivial curve because there is this sigma 8 quantity there, which is the root mass square fluctuations in spheres of 8 times h minus 1 megaparsecs. So this is something very specific that one has to compute, and it is model dependent, because this sigma 8 in particular, it depends on the density contrast, it depends on the transfer function, it depends on some filters that you use for the calculation. I'm just telling you that if you take other models, in particular models in which the vacuum energy is not just the constant, but it is dynamical, meaning that it depends, for example, on the redshift, and you recompute all this, and you compare the quality of the fit of the standard model with the quality of the fit of the dynamical vacuum model, it can be improved substantially. I can also quantify how much is this. For example, if one uses the so-called Akaike information criterion, which depends on the value of the chi-square, and it also gets penalized by the number of parameters that your model has, when you compare the two values of this criterion, which is very well known, actually, you get that the standard model, the lambda CDM model, for example, is 10 points away using this criterion as compared to these dynamical vacuum models. If you, what it means, 10 points away? It means that the comparative value of the probability that the lambda CDM is better than the other model is more, is around 150 times worse, because it goes like the exponential of the half the value of this archaic information criterion. I mean, it is just a comment, because of course you have this curve which is from the lambda CDM, and then of course you can take other models in the market and see whether they fit better. I don't know whether there are other models fitting better this curve, but I can tell you that at least there is a class of them, is my comment.
So my answer to this is two. Yes, I think people are well aware that you can pick other models and you can vary parameters and you can get better fits. One of my students wrote a paper a few years ago showing precisely that. As a little bit of a game with a current student, I gave this, I tried it. Unfortunately, I really don't take those results very seriously. And I don't take results very seriously because look at the size of the error bars. Look at the size of the error bars, that's the first thing. But more importantly, look at the size of the error bars and compare with the scatter in the mean. That shows that clearly people still haven't understood the systematics in the calculation of these data points. And the systematics are a number. There's bias, there's nonlinear corrections, which are really important. And so before I do any statistical analysis using likelihood curves, using the Akaiki information theorem, I think we need to have better data. So I really don't think, I don't think we're in a situation now to try and say that one model is better than the other with this data. In fact, if you look at the recent Planck paper, if you add the RSD data, it does what you say. It pushes it away from lambda CDM. So there's clearly a problem. But again, this analysis does not include systematic effects. So I just don't take it seriously.
I have just a comment to your comment. I will be brief. I mean, of course, I agree with you that here the error bars are big. But of course, I mean, the kind of fit that I was talking about is not only on the linear growth data. It involves all kind of data, actually. Supernova data, baryonic acoustic oscillations, mm-hmm. and all what is known about the value of the Hubble function at different redshifts, for example. Okay. Also, it takes into account, for example, the CMB shift parameter. So there is a lot of points, data points, which are involved in this redshift, not just this data with big error bars on the linear graphs. So when you put everything together, the result is the one I have mentioned.
Any further reaction on that?
I know. I mean, there's a whole industry of people fitting their favorite models to the data. I think the big problem is that lambda CDM, unfortunately, GR plus lambda fits the data so well that what can we do?
Fits the data too well. So that terminates then this discussion, and I'd like to thank Professor Ferreira for some very nice lectures and discussions.